Blog Talk Radio.
Transformed.com. This program explores a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. The World Transformed is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in helping to bring about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future, and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that will occur in your life, in your world, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I am doing great also. Doing great.
Very good.
Having a good summer so far.
Yeah, anything interesting going on in your life this week?
Shreveport is sort of an interesting town in a number of ways, and one of them is that it's just huge when it comes to competitive swimming. There are so many different swim clubs in this town, and so kids from like all over town, it's just a big deal. Like, you know, there are towns that are big into baseball during the summer, and we have that too. But you know, there are towns that emphasize it more than us, and we just have a lot of competitive swimming, and my two youngest have gotten into it in a big way, and I've really enjoyed watching them. They're weekly swim meets during the summer, where you know, meet at various clubs and swim competitively. That is fun. We've had a good time cheering them on.
Oh, that sounds great. Yeah, it goes on all summer, huh?
All summer long. So, fun stuff.
Fantastic. Well, keep us posted on that. Yeah, I'm having a good summer too. You know, I finally got over this virus thing that I was fighting for. I don't know. It seems like
forever.
The last.
You've had that a while. A
couple of months anyway.
Glad to hear it.
And.
Really.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, so it's and the weather's nice, and so I'm out of my bike. I'm finally able to get back out of my bike, and I'm really enjoying that. It's a great time of year for mountain biking. And now wildfire season has come, and the air is just thick with smoke, in addition to all the real problems, serious problems. 90 people lost their homes down there in the Colorado Springs area. But I'm quarantined back into the house. I'm like, well, I'm not going out in this. Because you have to be really careful when the air gets full of smoke. So we're hoping to get those wildfires resolved here very soon.
If you're out there huffing and puffing and that stuff, that could potentially be dangerous. You could overheat or whatever. Huh?
Well, you know, the one time in my life I got pneumonia. It was from being outside walking. It was actually in Malaysia, but they were having. They were having controlled burn over in Sumatra, and all the smoke had blown into KL, and that weather inversion El Nino thing, there was no rain, and it just stayed there for, I don't know, like weeks on end, and man, I got really, really sick. It's a dangerous thing. You gotta watch what you put in your lungs, kids. That's my little health tip.
Your PSA for the evening is...
For starting the show. Be careful what you put in your lungs, yes. Yeah. Wildfire smoke is definitely to be avoided, yeah. And All the best to the brave folks down there fighting that fire. They know that they have to avoid that. They're wearing all the protective gear to make sure that that they're not inhaling too much of that stuff. Well, anyhow, we've got a topic that's far removed from fighting fires tonight. This is almost kind of the opposite. I decided to give the show one of those kind of over the top bombastic titles. I got to thinking about the topic, Stephen, that I had suggested to you was that we talk about happiness and the future of happiness. But that didn't seem big enough. So I put these words together, the joy explosion, okay? The happiness singularity. Is such a thing imaginable? Is such a thing possible? What would that be like if that were to occur? And I've got some thoughts on maybe how we'll get there, and I think you do as well. But before we get to that part, and before we talk about what it is that makes us happy and what it is that might be holding us back, I thought we'd talk a little bit about what we potentially might have to be happy about in the future, and potentially what we have to be unhappy about in the future, and see if those things offset or if we see an edge for happiness. But maybe before we do any of that, just to kind of set the stage. Is happiness, do you think, Stephen, an appropriate topic for The World Transformed?
Oh, yeah. I mean, what we're concerned about, obviously, is the future in general and how the world develops going forward. And, one of the things we really want to strive for, as a country is, we've always said here in the United States, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I've always found that interesting. The founding of our country, we did not say "and happiness." We always said "and the pursuit of it," knowing that perfect. I think it was just sort of a acknowledgement on the part of the founders of our country that perfect happiness may not be possible, but that the pursuit of it should never be. One person shouldn't stand in the way of someone else's pursuit of it. And,
exactly, yeah. I mean, if you're going to state it as a right, you have the right to be alive, you have the right to your own personal freedom, your own liberty, and it sounds right to say people have the right to be happy, but actually, it depends on what would make them happy, right? Whether they whether they have the right to be happy.
My right to be happy, stops at when my happiness really treads on other people's rights too, right? So
I think so, yeah. So you have the right to try to be happy.
That's right.
To achieve your happiness.
As long as my pursuit does not get in the way of everyone else's pursuit, then let me pursue it. So.
And it's funny you should go there because I was actually thinking about that phrase from the Declaration of Independence earlier today, and it occurred to me that phrase, the pursuit of happiness, is a restatement of the human imperative. It's a quick statement of the human imperative. It's what people are all about anyway. When we talk about the human imperative, we don't talk about it in terms of happiness, but that's really what's going on. This phenomenon that we've described as the human imperative, which is basically from prior to the time we were even what you would call human, we seem to have been involved in this endless, relentless effort to improve things, to make our own circumstances better, to make the circumstances of the people around us better, to improve, things for our tribe, ultimately for our for our family or for ourselves. Then you get these larger, more lofty notions as time goes by for one's nation or for one's planet. And now we have transhumanists who think about the good of the whole universe. What's the best course forward for all living beings, for all intelligences, and for all non-sentient beings that even can suffer? I mean, so this perspective, it broadens and broadens and broadens, but it's always with this effort to try to make things better. And most people, I think, if you ask them why they want to make things better, it's because they want to be happy. It comes down to that. The pursuit of happiness and the pursuit of improving the world or improving one's own lot in life are so closely linked that I'm not even sure we have to make a distinction between them. I think that the two things have an awful lot to do with each other. So since we talk about the human imperative, and I think it's one of the big drivers of everything we talk about on this show, I think it's completely appropriate for us to talk about happiness and to talk about the future and happiness. Is the future going to be a happy time relative to the present? And so I thought, how about we do this, Stephen? You want to just kind of bounce back and forth between things that we have to be happy about in the future and things that we might want to be worried about in the future? We'll do like one of each.
That sounds better. Let's rather than do all the happiness up front and then backload the unhappiness, let's go back and forth. So why don't you start with a happy topic, and I'll go with an unhappy topic to follow up.
Okay. So a very obvious one we talk about all the time is abundance, post-scarcity. And we talk about post-employment, post-drudgery, post-work. But something that we have to be happy about in the future, we talked about it a bit last week, and we've talked about it a bit on almost every show we do, is the fact that scarcity, as we have known it, is going to be eliminated, is on its way out. And you know, that's a little scary because it's one of the big drivers of economy as we've always understood it. But the good news is we're talking about the end of hunger. We're talking about the end of want. The end of need, and ultimately the end of want. We're talking about people not being deprived of any material good thing that they need. People having enough food to eat, people having shelter, people having clothing, people having the freedom to pursue happiness because they're not tied to trying to keep themselves alive. And basically a world that has had one of the most persistent and lethal of all of our enemies eliminated. That's a happy world right there, okay? A world where there's no such thing as poverty, a world where there is no such thing as hunger. It seems to me inherently a happy world. If we actually believe that we're heading towards abundance, and I'm convinced that we are, then it seems to me that that's got to be a happier world than the world we live in. A world that has people who are starving to death, and a world that has people, it's got to be happier than a world that has nobody starving to death has got to be happier than a world that has people starving to death, put it that way. A world where everyone has enough to eat is a happier world than one where people starve to death. What do you think?
Absolutely. I do not believe that happiness is a zero-sum game where we can be happy in this country only if other countries are being deprived or other people are being deprived so that we can be happy. Happiness doesn't work like that. I believe that there ought to be enough pie to go around where everybody gets a piece. And absolutely.
That's the whole thing about post-scarcity is it's enough pie to go around.
That's the deal. You are right. And you know what we've seen over the last, 25, 30 years especially, is are some amazing gains in various parts of the world, where you just don't see the kind of famine that you used to see. And many parts of the world are developing very quickly. And that's encouraging. I think there's much less poverty today than there was when I was born, and much less than 20 years ago. So
there you go.
We see progress.
Right there in that 2 decade ago.
Absolutely.
I think that's true. And we talked about that a while back when we were looking at these awesome statistics about how many people have been lifted out of poverty. One of the millennium goals of the United Nations got met, and no one seemed to notice in terms of lifting people out of extreme poverty. These facts
we laugh cynically about that, Phil, because it happened, and the reason it wasn't noticed is there was no program that got us there. It just sort of happened organically, and therefore,
if you want to be real cynical, there was no bureaucrat who could take credit for it, right?
That's the point.
So it went by unheralded.
And that's very sad. I think we should put that as one of the sad topics, is that there was no bureaucrat to take credit for that. So
I'll tell you what. Why don't we just say, Stephen, that you are the bureaucrat who gets credit? Okay, we're gonna backdate some certification for you as the guy in charge of this, and you're gonna get full honor,
the whole work.
But it's true. You know what that reminds me of? To a greater extent, this happened to a lesser extent with something else really significant that happened in our lifetimes, which was the end of the Cold War. and the fall of the Berlin Wall. The end of the Cold War should have been this massive VE Day, VJ Day kind of celebration. And, you know, people were pretty happy about it, but it went almost kind of like not unnoticed, but, well, there you go. I guess Cold War's over. Kind of thing. And again, I think it was because there was no one person who you could say he did it, you know, unless it was, you know, you certainly give Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan and people like that, a lot, like Valenza, people like that, a lot of credit, not to take anything from them. But there was no like one decisive thing. Exactly. Yeah. No one decisive thing that said it's over. And it sort of happened under the radar, and then we look back and said, wow, that was huge. That was so huge. And I think that lifting all these people out of extreme poverty is the same kind of thing. And I think it's a portent of things to come. I think things are going to continue to get better in those regards, and we're going to notice it even less.
Let me tell you, Phil, I was in Berlin when the wall came down. And you talk about a party. You know, maybe the rest of the world wasn't really.
Oh, yeah. No, there, I'm sure,
that,
yes.
That town rocked, I mean, that, when that was going on. That was a truly fun time. When I think of that week, I'm reminded a little bit of the sailor grabbing the nurse and bending her down and kissing her. That picture from World War II. It's the same kind of feeling that whole city had. And
well, good. I'm glad they had it in Germany anyway, and rightly so that they would. Yeah. We should have had some of that here too. Okay, so there you go. So that's the thing. Yeah. I think post-scarcity abundance, that's the thing to be happy about. How about something that we might be unhappy with in the future, Stephen?
This is sort of in the news a lot right now, and for obvious reasons. Loss of privacy.
Mm, yes.
And this is something we should, you know, I think that is of concern. I find this interesting because, you know, it transcends politics. I have a number of Facebook friends from all across the political spectrum, and nobody is happy with the domestic spying that our government seems to be engaged in, you know, with the cooperation of all of our favorite internet companies, you know. Facebook, Google, you name all the big ones, and they're cooperating to turn over private information, pretty much. To, you know, it's not something. And here's the thing, we as we're going forward, it seems to me that the potential is that it could get much, much worse. Now, you know, I think we're at a turning point. Either we're going to say, you know what? No way. It's not right for any administration to be engaged in the collection of data like this. You can call it national security if you like, but we're going to take our freedom and do something different regarding our own security. Or we could embrace it and go a very different route. And then when you have AGI kicking in and the ability to monitor this, you get to the point that we don't have any unmonitored thought at all going on, and that's not cool at all. I see libertarians to the right of me, and I see my good friends that are far, far to the left of me. Just all in agreement that this is not cool at all, and we need to, something needs to be done to communicate that this is not acceptable. So that is a concern.
Listen, nobody likes this because stay the hell out of my stuff, right? I mean, everybody thinks the same thing. You can think whatever you want to about it theoretically, but this is personal to all of us.
Right.
Right. This is our own information. It's our own lives being looked at. And I'll tell you, what's really interesting about this, Stephen, because you and I travel in a lot of the same circles and we follow a lot of the same people and talk to a lot of the same people. And one of the truisms that the accelerating future community embraces is that, maybe in the future there will be no privacy. Maybe in the future we'll have a completely transparent society and we'll have surveillance and all that kind of stuff. I don't hear many of my futurist friends talking about that right now in the light of the scandal, which I think is kind of interesting. But one of the reasons that that model doesn't really apply is because that is a binary model. That is a back and forth model where we have a view into what the government's doing to the same extent that they have a view into what we're doing, and we've come to this kind of détente, right? Where we know they're looking at us, and they know we're looking at them, and it's a kind of a mutual assured management of each other. Now that's not what's happening here. What's happening here is the deal was you're not supposed to be looking at us, and you are, right? You know, we haven't moved to this new deal, and we don't get to see what you're doing, and we didn't know you were looking at us. So this is just, you know, old school. You violated our privacy, and that won't stand. Creepy.
You know, I mean, it's just it's Big Brother. I've read that basically if they wanted to, they could sit there and watch you type. You know, on your laptop. It's just it's creepy stuff. You know, the other thing is the phone monitoring and everything. Again, they're you know not listening in on calls apparently, but they're you know they can track who's calling whom and you know run it through algorithms and you know find out you know various things about you know who you're communicating with. It's I don't know. It's just it's kind of creepy and it's. It's different, I think, than you know corporate monitoring in a way. You know, corporations gather data on us in order to sell us stuff, right? Well, this is, I think, this is much more about control, and of the populace, and you know, that is something that I do not look forward to if that's going to be the direction we go in. And my hope is that we're able to communicate that no, that's not going to be the way we go. And that these programs have to be dismantled, but we'll see.
It's very, very Orwellian picture of the future. It suggests, or not the present, for crying out loud, that it suggests. But when you push it forward to the future, there you go. So we've got two offsetting now. We're going to be very happy in the future because of post scarcity, but maybe not feeling so great about the world because we're constantly being poked at and looked at, and we don't have a private moment or a private thought to ourselves. Okay, so those two offset pretty nicely. I'm gonna give you a turn now to give us a good one, and then I'll give a bad one.
Okay. Health. Just an explosion of breakthroughs in the areas of cancer, heart disease, diabetes, obesity, hypertension. These problems are going to be solved, and I believe they're going to be solved within 10 to 15 years for the most part. And, you know, that is a majority. You know, you take away these problems and you will vastly improve the lives of the world. You know, if these problems are solved, then you extend lives, you make lives happier, and much fewer of us will be grieving the loss of friends and loved ones with these problems solved.
And that's a happy world, right?
Yeah, that is a much happier world. You know, just pick one, cancer. You know, think of all the people that you've lost in your life, Phil, or you know, friends, family members, just a bat.
Yep.
You know, having them back in your lives, we'd be happier people. I know that I would be if all the friends and family that I've lost due to that one thing were back with us. You know, add in heart disease, diabetes, obesity, hypertension, all these problems that are really chronic problems of the civilized world in a way.
Well, not to mention, it's true we'd all be happier to have our friends and loved ones with us, and people would be happier not to suffer from those things.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other, the other side of it is the pain and the dread and the fear and just all the horrible stuff that goes with cancer or you know, it's the chronic pain that people have with arthritis and other chronic illnesses, lupus and things like that. The thought that those are all going to be gone is it sounds almost too good to be true. But I think I think as we've discussed many times, there are good reasons to believe that disease will come to an end, that the world will not experience disease in the way that it currently does. And that's going to be a wonderful, wonderful future. It should be a very happy time, right? People should be delighted about the end of disease. Well, I've got one actually that spins right back on that.
Okay.
And in fact, I put together a list that they're all just based on kind of the downside of the good side. Okay. And once you get life extension, radical life extension, which to me is exactly the same thing as eliminating disease. I think if you've solved the one problem, you've probably solved the other. That if disease is completely gone, I would include in disease those seven kinds of damage that happen at the cellular level that cause us to age. So we're saying it's all gone now. And
right.
You know, the downside to that is that what's left of our mortality, the bus is going to get you. You know, that you could have an accident, that something scary bad could happen to you in terms of an accident. That's going to be very scary to us. That's going to be more scary to us in that world than it is to us now. In the same way that probably people from a century ago would look at us and look at our seatbelts and our, you know, child restraints and just, you know, all the stuff that we do and think that we're unbelievable fraidy cats, right? That we're living our whole lives worried sick about death, you know. And in earlier times in human history, it was just always right around the corner. Well, I think that continues now. You know, it's like we live longer and we're a lot more averse to physical risks probably than we were in earlier times. You take disease and aging out of the equation altogether, and people are going to be terrified, I think, of physical risks. I think that it will be crippling. One of the reasons that we'll probably end up with the virtual—we didn't call it virtual reality. What was the term? I can't remember that we used a couple of
weeks ago. Similarity.
Yeah. Thank you. When we end up there, one of the reasons is that people are going to do that because they don't want to go out into the real world and risk getting hit by the bus. They don't want to risk something bad happening to them. And although the incidences of people being in accidents or being harmed by other people are going to go way down, our fear of them is probably going to go up exponentially. And we're going to live in a world that is vastly improved and that will still be very scary to us, is my prediction. So that all the happiness brought to us by the elimination of disease is going to be significantly offset by our fear of physical mortality. What do you think?
Well, I think that there's a chance it could go that way. Certainly, Aubrey de Grey thinks so. When we've had him on the show, he would talk about how that people will become risk adverse because they've got so much life left in front of them. You know,
right?
If you've got 20 or 30 years in front of you, you might have a certain amount of risk adverseness that you would have. But if you got a 1,000 years to live in front of you, then you might be much more careful. You know what? It might go a different way though. And let me give the counter argument to that. I think that the reason people in their 20s do things like, you know, bungee jump and, you know, crazy extreme sports, rock climbing and all these things more than people in subsequent decades of their lives is because the price that is paid immediately following those activities for a 20-year-old is very small. The recovery time from going and, you know, for a pulled muscle or whatever, you know, number one, you don't get pulled muscles as much, but when you do, you recover much quicker and you're right back out there having fun again pretty quick. Whereas I can tell you, a couple of decades later, you know, you're just going to pay a price for a lot longer.
Right.
When you go down, getting up, it's going to hurt a little more, and it's going to hurt a little longer, and, you know, it's just the way it is. And so people end up doing those things less and less as they get older, not just because they're risk-averse, but they just don't want to pay the price that an aging body makes them pay. And so perhaps people in their 70s and 80s will be out there doing these crazy things again because they can do them and it doesn't hurt. And it feels, you have a young body again, feeling how wonderful that feels again, maybe out there doing it just as much or even more. We'll see.
We
there may be some combination of of the two, whereas you're doing sports that have a perceived level of thrill and risk, but the real risk is rather low. You know, a little like going to an amusement park where you get to ride these rides that make you feel like you're about to die but have very low risk. I don't know. Maybe there'll be a lot of activities like that.
Could be. Could be. We had some friends over about a week ago, and our one friend, her son, climbed up. He's like 7 years old. He climbs up to the top of the swing set, and he's standing up there, and she tells him, get off there. Don't stand up there. You don't stand up there. And so, you know, the instruction was not specific in terms of how he was to get down, but we were all thinking climb back down the way you got up, clearly. And what does he do? He just jumps, right? He just jumps right off the top of the swing set and just lands perfectly. You know, he lands perfectly in the grass, and he's fine. He gets up and runs, and, you know, life goes on. But my friend, she looks at me, and she goes, I can feel that in my knees when he landed. I'm like, I know exactly what you mean. I'm just like, you see him do that, and you go, oh! But, of course, it didn't, you know.
You're fine, kid, but I'm going to hurt for a couple of days thinking about, you know, what if I'd have done that? Yeah,
I mean, if I'd have jumped, forget that relative distance, just the distance he jumped. You know, I didn't end up in the hospital, right? You know, and that's the difference, right? You get to the point where you go, rock climbing. I don't know. You know, getting up the stairs sometimes is a bit of a challenge. I'm not sure I'm gonna do the rock climbing. I think that's true. That a lot of the risk of aversion that gets built in is just a very natural defense mechanism. Right, you can feel how your body is going to respond to a certain situation, and we're pretty good at avoiding pain. We try to be, that speaks to if we're healthier and our bodies are stronger. Yeah, maybe that does go away. That one's a big question mark for me. I have a feeling that people are going to seem in the future very squeamish to us. That kind of prissy to us, only because I think we would probably strike people from earlier eras that way, and I think that trend, a lot of the drivers of that are likely likely to continue. But as you say, there are some mitigating factors, and old people will be young in the future, at least physically. But I wonder how long the adaptation period is, right? Because, you know, if they gave me knees tomorrow that wouldn't hurt if I jumped off the swing set, I don't know how soon I'd start doing it. You know what I mean?
You'd be like, you know what? I could feel that in my lower back. You know, there'd be other parts of the body.
Exactly. Yes.
I think it just pays to be young. You know, it really, really does.
It's the body and the set of expectations. They go together nicely. Yeah, if you're young, I would recommend staying with that as long as you possibly can. I think that's the kind of useful advice we dole out on this program. Okay, so we've done one good and one bad each. Do you have any more goods or bads? Anything else that comes to mind that you want to throw out there?
Is it my turn to go with a good or a bad? Which would you
give us some happiness, Stephen? Let me
dole out a little happiness here then. How about radical abundance? I think we've kind of touched on that already. And this is something we've talked about a lot recently. I think just radical automation of factories. It's our old joke of the factory being manned by the man and the dog. The man to feed the dog,
sure.
The dog to bite the man if he touches the machine.
Yep.
Radical automation where just anything you can imagine is produced and what it costs just keeps dropping and dropping and dropping for any product that you can imagine. 3D printing is a big part of that. When you can make it in your own home we all often say with dirt and sunlight to the power of the solar printer, and dirt to be your feedstock for it. You can make anything that way, and we just live in a world that's just, you know, we just have an abundance of things. Nanofactories make it even better, where you're building things from the molecular level, and we talked about that recently. And it seems like, particularly with things like the internet connecting us, that there's increased possibility for just a small bands of people to serve the entire planet. I think about places like Google, which have just a small number of employees by comparison to, say, you know, a motor company, okay, like Ford or, you know, Chrysler or somebody. You know, they have a fraction of the number of employees that those companies have, and yet they serve the entire world and in incredible ways. And so I think there's just going to be increasing possibilities for, you know, small groups of people to do things that help everybody. So that's a big deal as far as increasing our wealth, or at least our ability to enjoy the world around us. And then when you got automation and 3D printing and now factories factoring as well, we just don't have any idea what that world is going to be like, but it's going to be much, much different. We're going to have to rebuild our ways of dealing with one another in a world just that wealthy.
But a happier world, or at least it should be.
Yeah.
A much happier world.
I agree.
And, you know, let me just build on some of those ideas, because, you know, I was thinking about some of these, when you start combining post-scarcity and post-mortality, when you start combining life extension and post-scarcity, you get this really great combination of things. This is where the sexy immortal billionaires really start to show up. You know, when we're post-disease, when we're post-obesity, when we're post-ugliness, right? I mean, when we're post anybody having to look any way other than how they want to look, or feel any way other than how they want to feel. And you just said it, you know, more people, more time in people's lives to self-actualize, to figure out what they think is important and to pursue those things. More time for people to focus on each other, to really help each other and to really build meaningful relationships with each other and do amazing things together that would never have been possible before. That's a fun world. That is an exciting and happy world. Now, my question is two-part question, Stephen. I'll give you this in two parts. One,
okay.
Will that world be the world of the joy explosion? Will that world be the world of the happiness singularity? Actually, that's question two. Question two, one is, will it be a happier world than the one we live in? And then question two is, will it actually make it to that level of the joy explosion, the happiness singularity? What do you think?
I think that it will be, but it's not, you know, put it this way. I think that it will be a happier world. I do not, you know, expect there to be the same kind of explosion in happiness for that kind of world than it is. Put it this way. Moving from grinding poverty where you don't know where your next meal is coming from to relative security when it comes to knowing about where your next meal is and you've got a roof over your head and, you know, that kind of thing. Moving from the grinding poverty to that point increases your happiness maybe tenfold, let's say. Moving from that point to, you know, I don't know, middle-class American lifestyle only increases your happiness maybe another point. And then moving from there to just bass wealth, maybe half a point. It's like we have built into us a certain amount of limits to how happy we can be, and it just seems like if the happiest person in the world ought to be Bill Gates, is just going around and you just can't get the smile off his face. Well, you know, he doesn't seem like an unhappy guy, but no. You know, is he the happiest person in the world? I don't think so. I think he's he's just fairly normal kind of guy as far as his level of happiness. You know, I would suggest that the thing might be pretty close to me.
Yeah, about that is we all do experience joy explosions. Okay, we all do experience these kind of singularity moments of happiness. At least I hope everyone does. I've had a few, in a human life when something you've really wanted to happen happens. You know, when your child is born, or when you fall in love, or when you land that job, or just, you know, you get recognition for something that really meant a lot to you, or just these, you know, somebody says something to you, and you've always wanted somebody to say that to you. You know, little tiny things can actually trigger it, and there's just this welling up of emotion, this sudden moment of joy that you can experience, but. But actually, that is a moment, generally speaking, or it's a brief period. And it almost seems that joy has to occur in explosions, because if, you know, it would be hard to maintain that state, right? How would you know if you were joyful, if you were joyful all the time, right? It almost by definition, it has to be kind of a spike in happy. You know, you could maybe be a moderately happy person all the time, or even a very happy person all the time. But as soon as you introduce the idea of joy, it seems that you've just kind of upped it, right? That you've taken it someplace else. But by that measure,
I've met some people that just seem like they just, I mean, were just joyful all the time. And I'm going to tell you, by and large, and most people treat them like they were weird or phonies or whatever. It just wasn't it's socially acceptable to be that happy all the time. It was sort of funny. And so, you know, I think most people just, you know.
But they didn't mind one bit, I bet. Yeah, you know.
No.
Anybody that happy,
you know,
it wasn't bothering them, right?
No, they were great, you know, because they really were happy. But, there are people that are gifted with that. They just they go around happy all the time, there are obviously people at the other end of the spectrum. I think much more people at the other end of the spectrum, unfortunately. But the vast majority of us exist somewhere in the middle and have moments of extreme happiness and then moments of extreme sadness, and just it's all part of the mix. And wealth does not change that. Once you reach a certain level of, you know, I'm not just always, you know, worried about my next meal. Once you get past that additional wealth on top of that, it's great to have, and it gives you more freedom to do different things. But it doesn't really change the happiness quotient that much.
Well, think about this. You know, you mentioned that you've known some truly joyful people. How about some truly miserable people? Have you known any of those? Because
I
have, right?
Oh yeah. I've known a lot more people like that. I tell you, and they're no fun to be around.
No matter what, they're going to be unhappy. You know, they're going to be miserable. They've just got a pretty sour way of looking at things, and they tend to be unhappy. Well, guess what? Those people are probably at just about the same economic level, right, as your joyful friends. You know, I mean, if you looked at their lives, the big difference is not how much material stuff they have now, is it?
No.
So if we're going to have an explosion of joy, it's probably not going to occur, even if we get all the material stuff we're looking for in the world, even if we cure all the diseases, and even if we all get to drive diamond, you know, platinum, whatever, Rolls Royces around. No matter what, that actually isn't going to move the needle that much. And you know, we're talking around some interesting findings in the field of positive psychology. And Steve and I had sent you this link, and I'm going to go ahead and put this in the chat room. This is a piece called Positive Psychology's Advice on How to Be Happy, and it's by Owen Sanders, and it's from his blog, which is called Frontier Neuropsychiatry. And this is a great piece. Basically, just a summary of what positive psychology has to tell us about how happiness happens, why we're happy, why we're unhappy, and it doesn't exactly work the way we expect it to. There are things that we would automatically suppose were the big drivers of happiness, genetics being one of them, and different studies show different things, but apparently your happiness is at most only about 50% genetic. So if you have a predisposition to go a certain way, that's going to account for about half of what you experience. But the other half comes from other areas, and half is the most. Some studies show as little as 22%. So you could potentially come from pretty gloomy people and still be a pretty happy person, or vice versa. The genes aren't necessarily going to be determinative. So that's one interesting thing. Genetics plays some role, but not nearly the role that we would expect it to play. And life circumstances, this is the one we were just talking about, things like age, ethnicity, significant events that shaped our childhoods, where we live, how healthy we are. I don't know if you've read this one, Stephen, but would you venture to guess how much of our happiness does that account for?
I didn't read it, so I would maybe 30%.
10%. Okay, so the variances among, you know, all the different classes and races and economic strata and everything else account for, you know, it's about 10%. If you're rich, you'll be about 10% happier, right, than somebody who's poor is the bottom line. So that's, you know, that's okay. Not nothing. But you might have a thousand times as much money.
I don't disagree with that. Based on my own just observations in life, I would say that's about right. I've met some people that, you know, I'm thinking, you know, I'd hate to have to struggle the way they are, and they're happier than my rich friends over here. You know, it's to some extent it's the ability to wake up and take delight in the world around you, regardless of your circumstances. You know, some people are good at it, and other people not so much. So yeah.
And the other side of it is that all the bad stuff that happens to us, it doesn't make us all that miserable, by and large.
Yeah.
I mean, people get depressed, and then that's a medical condition. But your happiness doesn't go down all that much. You know, you think if you have this huge life-changing circumstance, whatever it is, you lose your job or you get a divorce or something like that, that all, you know, the happiness is going to be drained out of your, the lights are going to go off in your life, and there'll be no more happiness. And, in fact, you get about a 10% bounce, right? From day to day, after something terrible has happened, and you've adjusted, so maybe you're about 10% less happy than you were. But then other things will happen, and it bounces back up. The point being that our circumstances don't have an awful lot to do with how happy they are. They have a little bit to do with it, and our genes have something to do with it, but they're not. Neither one of them are necessarily determinative, and it has to do with a phenomenon called hedonic adaptation. It's our ability to get used to stuff. And this is a thing that we've discussed under a different guise many times, because we've talked about the fact that any utopia will always be a relative utopia. We don't believe in absolute utopias. And the reason we didn't use this term, but the reason we don't is because we understand the principle of hedonic adaptation. That if you take human beings and you put them in utopia, they will find new things to be worried about, tense about, pissed off about.
We will,
right?
Invent new problems like bad hair day or something, you know.
Yes.
That was a problem that they didn't, you know, the greatest generation did not ever worry about a bad hair day, you know.
Right.
They were busy,
in the trenches, in World War II was concerned about whether they were having a bad hair day. Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. That's right, but you know, given time and enough security and wealth, and you can come up with all kinds of interesting new problems, and I completely agree with that. Hedonic adaptation. If you grow up in a family where a five-car garage filled with classic automobiles is just a given, then it's going to be hard to adapt to a life with something less, perhaps, and even a life that would be comparatively awesome by comparison to your neighbors might be tough to take once you've adapted to a certain level, I guess.
That's right. Well, and then there's something else, because we've talked about all the things that don't drive happiness. It's like, okay, so some people really are happy. Right, your joyful friends, right? They're truly happy. Well, maybe they had the genetics, and maybe they got some lucky breaks in life. But why are some people so much happier than other people? And this is where positive psychology really begins to reveal some interesting stuff. What's the difference between happy people and unhappy people? Well, you will not be surprised to hear the first one is optimism. Okay, if you have a tendency to think positively, to view good things that are going to happen as likely to happen, and to view bad things that have happened as kind of the exception, or rather a temporary setback on the way to making more good stuff happen, you're happier. Optimism and happiness, almost they're almost two sides of the same coin. It's almost a willful act of happiness to be optimistic. And then there's some other ones as well. That they mentioned, which I'm not so sure about. I don't mean to argue with the academics who've done the studies and they know what they're talking about, but this one struck me as interesting. To neutralize pessimistic thinking, Seligman recommends arguing with oneself and disputing one's negative thoughts and beliefs. Well, I understand that you want to get rid of those negative thoughts and beliefs, but for me, it's never been a matter of disputing them. To me, it's not about debating them. I just put a positive one in place. That's, tactically speaking, that's how I do it. I just I focus on something related that's actually good. Now, someone who knows psychology is listening to this and going, "Well, Phil, you're in huge denial. That's your deal." So, and you know, that could be. And some people might say that's what being an optimist is.
But I'm happy here in denial. Maybe I don't.
But you know what? And the only reason I said it is because to dispute them is to then spend time with them, right? It's then to give them power. And I try. I actually I try my best not to do that. But whatever works. There's also a caution against.
If you're focused on the silver lining rather than the cloud, if you're arguing the cloud, you're focused on the cloud still, right? Instead of focusing on the silver lining. So yeah. Man, I can see your point. I can see your point on that.
I think if people if there's things that are negative in your life that you need to address, then you've got to think about them long enough to fix them. You know, if you've really got a problem, you're doing something wrong, you've got behavior that's hurting other people, or something like that.
An abusive relationship or something like that. Things have to change, and you have to face it to change it.
Right.
Absolutely.
But these negative ideas people have about themselves, that they're ugly or they're not smart enough, or they can't do things very well. Those kinds of things I don't think should be entertained. I just think you just immediately, you know, I wouldn't dispute it. I would just say I'm awesome. You know, that would be the thought I would give myself, and I would move on to thinking about something else. But that's just me. Another one that they mention is
good
you
enough,
have to avoid
enough, doggone it, people like me.
Doggone it, people like me, exactly. this avoidance of judging oneself in comparison to others, social comparison. This is the source of misery for people. If you live your life looking at what other people are doing, judging your own performance in life against what other people are doing, it's very difficult to be happy. That's like the big the big buzzkill for happiness. And then the one more positive one for building happiness.
I'm going to just throw in on that one. I have noticed a common thread among a lot of unhappy people that I've met is this idea that somehow, you know, the person down the street has a nicer car than them, and they don't deserve that. I deserve.
Right.
You get focused on deserve. Now, it's not. I'm going to tell you, it doesn't come to you because of deserve. I'm a better person, therefore I
should have that car. Yes.
I should have that car. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's not the way the world works. You know, the richest man in the country is not necessarily the best person in the country. You might go find the guy that gave away the most money, maybe to find the best person. But it seems like that really kills happiness. If you're focused on that will sap your joy faster than anything
else. You got to forget that deserve thing, because if the world worked that way, all your good stuff would be taken from you and given to some really nice poor person.
That's right.
Who's much nicer than you, no matter how nice you might happen to think you are.
Please, let's not live in a world like that. I know people that deserve my stuff more than me. Exactly.
Yeah. So as soon as you start comparing yourself to other people, I think it's a terrible trap, and it's a great block to happiness. So the last one I'll mention here of these strategies, and read the article. I put the link up there. It's terrific, terrific collection of findings on positive psychology. Savoring, the awareness of pleasure and the deliberate conscious attention to the experience of pleasure. Just taking the time to enjoy the things that you enjoy in life, whether that be a good meal or time that you spend with your family or whatever it is, reading a good book, whatever it is, actually being consciously aware of how much you enjoy it and taking the time to appreciate that. And in fact, taking the time to appreciate the good things in your life seems to be one of the things that makes people a bit more dispositionally optimistic and generally makes them happier over time. So these are the things. These are the things that can work to make people happier. But because of the hedonic adaptation, we know that in the future things are likely to be better, but we're not likely to be that much happier. So even with post-scarcity and all the great things that we mentioned. Although the upside of that is things could be worse. All the bad things that we talked about could happen, and we still might be just about as happy as we are now. So maybe we shouldn't worry as much about all the bad things. But put all that aside for a moment, because we spent too much time on that, and we're almost out of time now. How do we really increase the amount of happiness in the world, assuming that changing our circumstances won't get us there? Do you have any thoughts on that, Stephen, before we close? How do we really bring about the explosion of happiness?
I don't know. Maybe we go in and we tweak ourselves medically. That's one way. I think one way is to find, this may sound corny or whatever, but I would say that finding ways to serve others that are in need is not a bad start. The people that serve in a soup kitchen or something on Thanksgiving Day, if you really want to be thankful for the things in your life, forego the big Thanksgiving meal at this coming Thanksgiving and go serve in a soup kitchen somewhere. You'll get a good feeling helping others, and you'll be very, very thankful for whatever you have waiting for you back at home. And get the focus off of your own circumstances. If your circumstances are keeping you down, if they're making you feel bad, about your life and what you've accomplished or whatever, get your focus off of that and focus on something else.
I think that's right. I think that in the long run, we have to look at doing this as an incremental process. We have to get better at being happy the same way we've gotten better at being smart, the same way we've gotten better at generating wealth. And it's an incremental process. And it's kind of the last big challenge that we get to take on. We had to survive and all that other stuff first. We had to not die and get here. Now I think we're turning the corner where we really can work on happiness. If there's a happiness explosion, if there's a happiness singularity to occur, it probably comes about through an incremental increase in dispositional happiness and people getting better and better at recognizing the things that lead to happiness. I think you're right, Stephen. Focusing on other people is a huge positive step that people can take. And we might take steps as we get further on. This is a transhumanist program, after all, to actually rework our own tendencies so that we naturally have them, so that we can accelerate that process. We can accelerate our intelligence. I think we'll be able to accelerate our happiness just by making a few tweaks about, I'm going to just shut down that wiring that makes me want to compare myself to my neighbor, and I'm going to augment that one that helps me to savor the good moments. And I think you start down that road, and pretty soon the exponential set in, and you get your happiness singularity. What's our music?
our music tonight is Lifetime by Zane Ludhawa.
Zane Ludhawa singing Lifetime. I'm sorry, Stephen, I didn't mean to cut you off there if you had a final thought on happiness.
I would just say enjoy a good book. I'm reading one now called Joyland by
Perfect
Stephen
title.
King.
There you go.
Yeah, and
oops.
I would say grab a good book and like that one and savor a few moments. That's a good idea. Anyway, the music tonight is Lifetime by Zane Ludhawa.
All right, Lifetime. Thanks, Stephen, for putting that together. Thanks, everyone, for being with us. We look forward to being with you all again next week on the next World Transformed. And I want you all to be happy in the meantime. And until next time, live to see it.